The Roots of Obama's Rage by Dinesh D'Souza, continued. Disc 2. Chapter 3. Obama's Private War. The best way to verify a theory is to test its explanatory power. Our theory, derived from Obama's testimony, is that he adopted his ideals from his father, and we know that his father's ideals were anti-colonial ideals. Based on this, we are in a position to examine the merits of our theory by checking it against what Obama is actually saying and doing. If the theory can account for Obama's major policies and enable us to predict what he is going to do in the future, then we are really onto something. But if the theory can also explain the little details about Obama, details that otherwise seem puzzling or mysterious, that would give our paradigm a degree of confirmation that very few comprehensive theories enjoy in politics. So let's see if our working hypothesis fits the data available to us. We do this by putting on anti-colonial spectacles and viewing the world through those lenses. Events are reported in the press one way, but we are going to see them Obama's way. This approach not only has the benefit of giving us a radically different angle of vision, it also enables us to see how Obama, who obviously cannot reveal his true motivations, must constantly translate his ideology into terms that are accessible and palatable to the American people. In other words, our theory about Obama also predicts his mode of rhetorical delivery. If we are right about him, then he has to be careful about what he says. He cannot say he hates the rich, so he has to talk about fairness and equality. He cannot say America is a nuclear menace to the world, so he has to say that he wants a nuclear-free world. He cannot say he thinks Wall Street is evil, so he must accuse the investment firms of not looking out for the interests of Main Street. Obama sometimes blows it. He doesn't always succeed with his anti-colonial marketing. Even his attempt, however, is impressive. This is a skill he has been honing for many years. Thus, even as we verify our working theory about Obama's ideology, we can also admire the translation skills of a true political artist. A good way to begin is with Obama's cool, detached temperament. Even typical liberal causes such as egalitarianism and the eradication of poverty don't seem to excite him. The minimum wage scarcely moves him as an issue, and he has never been known to show a passion for recycling. But Obama's voice rises in pitch when he condemns the scoundrels on Wall Street or gives a tongue-lashing to the CEOs of large banks or insurance companies. "The rich in America have little to complain about," Obama wrote in The Audacity of Hope. Recently in Illinois, he condemned well-heeled executives for trying to earn as much as possible. Obama snapped, "I do think that at a certain point you've made enough money." This seems like an odd thing for a president to say. Isn't it good for America that Steve Jobs and Warren Buffett, who have more money than they can ever spend, still continue to do what they are doing? I am not concerned, however, with the merits of Obama's statement. Rather, I want to draw attention to what makes the guy irritable and mad, what makes him go bitter and sarcastic on us. The answer? Big corporations and rich people. Obama seems to have a long-standing prejudice against these groups. After graduating from college in 1983, Obama hoped to become a community activist. But first, he went to work for a company to make some money. He described himself as a spy behind enemy lines in a consulting house to multinational corporations where he allegedly hung out with financiers and bond traders. "I had my own office, my own secretary, money in the bank." Dan Armstrong, a former work colleague, pointed out on his blog that Obama had no private office and no secretary. Nor was he employed by a major consulting firm, but rather as a copy editor for a small, low-paying newsletter company. Obama's exaggeration is not important here. What is important is his attempt to portray even his service at this lowly outpost of capitalism as a kind of political espionage. On May 13, 2009, Obama delivered the commencement address at Arizona State University, where he told the graduating seniors, "You're taught to chase after the usual brass rings, being on this who's who's list or that top 100 list, how much money you make and how big your corner office is, whether you have a fancy enough title or a nice enough car. Let me suggest that such an approach won't get you where you want to go. It displays a poverty of ambition." It may seem strange for a president to be lecturing students on the perils of economic striving in the teeth of a recession. But if you recognize that when Obama hears the word profit, he thinks of neocolonial exploitation, then all of Obama's stern rhetoric becomes comprehensible. Not that it makes sense, but we can see why he said it. Notice how artfully he puts it, though. The poverty of ambition is a typical Obama phrase. Obama criticizes ambition, but not in the name of modesty or restraint. Rather, he implies that there is some higher form of ambition just waiting to be discovered by a new generation of young people. Could it be that this ambition is for organized activism against rich people and profit-making companies? Obama's own chosen vocation? Now let's take up Obama's attitude toward Europe, and specifically toward those former colonial powers, the French and the British. Obama visited Europe for around 3 weeks in 1988 before joining his father's family in Africa. For all its elegance and splendor, Europe didn't impress Obama. On the contrary, it alienated him. "By the end of the first week or so," he wrote in Dreams from My Father, "I realized that I'd made a mistake. It wasn't that Europe wasn't beautiful. Everything was just as I'd imagined it. It just wasn't mine." For Obama, Europe is a kind of distraction or delay from where he really wants to be, which is Africa. This may seem odd, given that Obama's mother is white and therefore he has just as much claim to a European heritage as to an African one. Yet for all its wealth and grandeur, or perhaps because of it, Europe annoys him while Africa continues to exert its irresistible appeal. By itself, this admission may mean little. But now, consider Obama's 2009 visit to Paris, where he was invited to dinner by the French Prime Minister Nicolas Sarkozy and his model wife Carla Bruni. The Obamas declined. Their refusal was odd, given that they were staying at the residence of the U.S. ambassador just yards from the Sarkozy residence in the Élysée apartments. The French press noted the snub, but there wasn't much of a ruckus, even among the usually prickly French. In fact, the Pew Research surveys showed that the Europeans in general, and especially the French, remain enthusiastic about Obama. How can this be explained if Obama has a streak that is anti-European and specifically anti-French? The answer, of course, is that Obama has won over the French by criticizing his own country. The French are sensitive to snubs of their leaders, but this is a small price to pay for an American leader who comes to France and apologizes for American arrogance. It was in Strasbourg, 3 months earlier, that Obama delighted the French by saying, "In America, there's a failure to appreciate Europe's leading role in the world. Instead of celebrating your dynamic union and seeking to partner with you to meet common challenges, there have been times when America has shown arrogance and been dismissive, even derisive." Much is forgiven in Paris for an American leader who kowtows in this way. Thus, Obama can bash neocolonial America and stiff the prime minister of the old colonialists, while at the same time basking in their adulation. Quite a rhetorical feat indeed. Obama's cold shoulder toward the French prime minister, however, was nothing compared to his treatment of the British. On March 7, 2009, then-British Prime Minister Gordon Brown visited the White House. Obama presented him with a set of wrongly formatted DVDs. This was hardly an adequate response to what Brown gave the Obamas, an ornamental penholder carved from the timbers of a British anti-slave ship from the 1880s. This was not an isolated lapse. Only 3 weeks later, on April 1, 2009, the Queen came to visit. Obama gave her an iPod. Reporting on the incident, the London papers pointed out that the Queen already owns an iPod. Not that Obama is incapable of graciousness. He was more than gracious, some said positively sycophantic, in bowing from the waist to the King of Saudi Arabia. But the ultimate insult to the English was when Obama, right upon assuming the presidency, came upon a bust of Winston Churchill in the Oval Office and promptly decided to return it. Churchill, of course, is routinely quoted by American presidents, and the bust had been loaned to America from the British government's art collection. In a way, it symbolized America's special relationship with Britain. Somewhat shocked by Obama's decision to remove the bust from the White House, British officials suggested that perhaps Obama could display it elsewhere. Obama declined. Chagrined, the British took it back, and the bust now sits in the residence of the British ambassador in Washington. Bizarre? It is if you think of Obama as just another socialist. Why would a socialist have such a violent reaction to a Churchill statue? Or remember Churchill solely as the fellow who guided the British to victory in World War II? But with his anti-colonial background, Obama probably remembers Churchill as an imperialist who soldiered for the empire in India and Africa. Churchill was opposed to India's independence movement and in 1942 famously said, "I have not become the king's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire." Even as late as 1954, when President Eisenhower raised with Churchill the idea of granting self-government to all remaining British colonies in Africa, Churchill responded that he was skeptical about universal suffrage for the Hottentots. In the 1950s, Churchill was prime minister during Britain's fight against the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya, the native country of Obama's father. So when we apply the anti-colonial hypothesis, we find that the inexplicable Churchill incident suddenly makes perfect sense. Let's move from the symbols of European empire to those of American patriotism. If Obama is vehemently opposed to a world defined in America's image, to Pax Americana, then we would expect him to be cagey and defensive about displays of patriotism that convey America's leadership in the world. Sure enough, a Time photograph from the presidential campaign shows Obama at a fundraising event with several other Democratic politicians. The magazine noted that the national anthem was playing, but the photo shows that Obama does not have his right hand over his heart, and he's the only one. Everyone else does. Network video footage of the event confirmed that Obama was the lone holdout in this traditional display of patriotic allegiance.